So we've met with some mission success. We're close to being on time. We'll see if the moderator of this panel can stick to that. The topics that our panelists are presenting today are perhaps more timely than many of them anticipated when they first chose them several months ago. That is, all of them started out in the fall, and then in January, we get the Defense Strategic Guidance that emphasized the need for greater engagement and partnering to help deal with the both emerging strategic challenges but also budget constraints. And the President laid out that, one, there would be a, quote, rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region. Two, that a, quote, smart defense approach to our NATO and European allies to, quote, pool, share, and specialize capabilities as needed to meet 21st century challenges. And lastly, three, quote, building partnership capacity elsewhere in the world is important to sharing the costs and responsibilities of global leadership. And so the guidance directed, quote, new partnerships with a growing number of nations, including those in Latin America and Africa. The guidance identified the challenges and the priorities. That's not the hard part. The hard part is now the how, and that's where these three fellows' work comes in. First, we'll hear from Commander Mike Hannon with the U.S. Navy, who's a federal executive fellow at the Atlantic Council. He'll be speaking on evolving U.S. maritime partnerships, how we can work with NATO and other European navies to support strategic rebalance. He's a 1991 graduate of the Naval Academy and a graduate of the War College. He served in a variety of naval intelligence assignments, participating in operations in Somalia, support democracy in Haiti, Desert Fox and Southern Watch strikes in Iraq, and most recently a senior intelligence officer on board the Eisenhower in support of ground forces in Afghanistan. He also served as a naval attaché in Germany. Then we'll hear from Captain Scott Clendenin, U.S. Coast Guard, who's a federal executive fellow with us at Brookings. He's going to be speaking on networking maritime security in Central America, how better to link with the region's maritime security services and combined operations at sea. He is a 1990 graduate of the Coast Guard Academy, as well as a graduate of the Joint Military Intelligence College and the Naval War College. He served five tours at sea on cutters, commanding three of them. He spent much of his time conducting operations in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific, extensive operational work with Latin America partner nations, and ashore he served in a variety of positions in Coast Guard intelligence, as well as serving as the Coast Guard attaché to the Dominican Republic. And finally, we'll hear from Colonel-Select Arthur Dwight Davis, who's National Defense Fellow for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict at the Naval Postgraduate School. He'll be speaking about regional soft headquarters, franchising the NATO model as a hedge in lean times. He's a 91 graduate of Auburn University and a graduate of the Air War College. He's a master navigator with close to 4,000 hours of flight time. And he's served in a variety of airframes from the T-34 to the C-130 in all its variants. He's commanded two squadrons. And in these tours, he served in a variety of operations, including Operation Deny Fight, Deliberate Force, Joint Venture in Bosnia, Enduring Freedom in Iraq. And it's notable to his topic that most of his aviation background has been in special operations, including most recently commanding the 551 Special Operations Squadron at Cannon Air Force Base. Finally, he gets a special prize for being the fellow who flew the farthest to join us. So with that, I'll turn it over to our panel.
Good morning. Actually, I'll have to just start out really quickly to follow up something that Peter said earlier. My talk here will be exactly my opinions. They're not policy. I don't speak for the Department of the Navy or the Department of Defense. The United States plans a realignment of defense priorities following a decade of combat in the Middle East and the emergence of growing powers in the Indian Ocean and Asian regions. Based on the President's new defense strategy guidance with a shift and priorities to the Pacific and the Persian Gulf, the United States must evolve its international partnerships in order to further our national interests. We must call on historic allies and partners, especially those in Europe, to assume more of the burden as security producers. Former Secretary of Defense Gates made this point very clear in his farewell address to NATO last year, challenging our allies to improve their own defense capabilities and those of the alliance. With the United States forced to take on additional security responsibilities in Asia and the Middle East, Washington will look to its European allies to take a leading role in managing certain crises and contingency operations, especially in the European periphery. The United States should strengthen bilateral efforts with specific European nations who can be leaders for security development, not only within the alliance, but also using external frameworks. But to whom should the United States look as enhanced maritime partners? Several European navies have unique strengths, modern capabilities, or historic relationships with depth beyond that of the United States Navy. The recent Libya conflict revealed the curse of both national interests and defense shortfalls within Europe. Therefore, to identify partners who could be valuable maritime security providers, the U.S. must identify who is both capable and willing to operate, and if that country's leadership will make the required defense investments. I argue that four small European navies, three NATO allies, and one Partnership for Peace member are prime candidates to provide unique aspects of maritime security which support the new U.S. defense strategy, these being Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and the Netherlands. These nations have signaled willingness to lean forward on security matters, either through policy declaration, operational commitment, or defense investments. I'll talk about my recommendations for specific capabilities or regional relationships in which the U.S. should encourage these nations to focus defense efforts and evolve into collaborative security providers. I've grouped Norway and Sweden together first in my discussion, and secondly, I'll touch on Denmark and the Netherlands. This is due to their regional or functional strengths that factor in the calculus, and you'll see where they can operate as leaders in a particular field. So first, Norway and Sweden. These two nations have extensive capabilities and mission sets where the United States Navy must expand maritime collaboration. Operations in the Arctic, littoral warfare in confined and shallow waters, and amphibious operations for humanitarian or peacekeeping efforts. The Arctic High North region is Norway's declared number one foreign policy priority. That nation has proactively engaged Russia as well as China on various Arctic concerns, ranging from search and rescue to maritime sea claim delineation. The United States seeks to ensure access to the growing availability of high north waterways due to climate change while maintaining national security needs. Search and rescue, as well as advancing intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities, are areas for direct military coordination with Norway and Sweden in the Arctic. Norway especially can act as an interlocutor to help shape Russian policies in the high north due to their own extensive bilateral efforts with Moscow on this issue. Norway has also focused investments on satellite coverage for communications and maritime domain awareness in the high north. Data sharing with Russia and China, experienced by Norway and Sweden, already encounter piracy operations in the Middle East and the Gulf of Aden region, can be a model for cooperation in the Arctic. Both Norway and Sweden have extensive experience in NATO and EU exercise operations involving mine countermeasures and inshore warfare. These nations can be significant leading partners with fellow allies in mine clearance should a contingency arise, not only in traditional NATO areas, but also in crisis choke points such as the Strait of Hormuz. Additionally, Norway and Sweden can host training efforts for mine hunting for militaries outside of Europe, specifically the Gulf Cooperation Council nations or Asian partners. Both Norway and Sweden have the facilities and expert cadres to build partnership capacity in these warfighting skills. Overall, littoral warfare is a skill set well known to the Swedish and Norwegian navies. Activities in constrained and shallow waters involving modern stealth corvettes, such as the Norwegian Skold or Swedish Visby-class ships, can support the U.S. Navy's own evolving littoral combat ship program and provide training to NATO or nations outside of Europe. The Baltic and North Sea regions offer unique training grounds for exercising a wide spectrum of littoral operations, ranging from high-intensity naval combat to ISR and even maritime domain awareness. The U.S. Navy has a gap in capabilities that may reduce its ability to establish and maintain sea control in a hostile environment in littoral regions. Norway and Sweden have the knowledge and skills to operate in this environment and may help mitigate our own shortfalls. The Swedish and Norwegian militaries also have a history of close partnerships in Asia, especially in undersea warfare. Sweden has an extensive track record of working closely with Singapore since the 1970s. These ties include the sale and production of modern submarines, associated crew training, and undersea research and development. Norway produces military technical cooperation with Malaysia, as well as seamanship training with Indonesia. These existing relationships could be expanded in collaboration with the U.S. Navy, not only to continue improvements in those existing partnerships, but also to expand to other Southeast Asian nations, such as the Philippines or Vietnam. Finally, with defense rebalance, the U.S. should seek leading nations to increase engagement in Africa. Norway and Sweden have long experience on the continent, either as part of the United Nations or EU peacekeeping operations, as well as humanitarian assistance and disaster response efforts. Additionally, Norway conducts search and rescue coordination with Angola, and both Norway and Sweden are involved with their own bilateral partnership programs to help develop coastal maritime capabilities for several West African nations. Norway and Sweden have decided to expand their own amphibious forces for partnership and humanitarian missions in Africa. The U.S. should look to engage with these two nations to help them transition to an active leadership role in the Africa Partnership Station effort and other AFRICOM engagement activities. Finally, shifting to Denmark and the Netherlands, these two nations have a highly developed naval platforms with advanced air warfare capabilities, benefiting the expansion of sea-based ballistic missile defense as part of the European phased adaptive approach. Three frigates from Denmark and four frigates from the Netherlands share the latest generation SMART-L long-range surveillance radar and the APAR phased array radar systems. Initial studies conducted with the United States concluded that with certain modifications, these radar systems could conduct ballistic missile defense tracking and intercept missions. The Netherlands and Denmark each are pursuing investments of around 250 euros for the required technology upgrades. Enhancing the afloat BMD network with Denmark and the Netherlands would establish a burden-sharing foothold for European missile defense. The Danes and the Dutch combined could provide seven BMD-capable platforms, nearly twice the number that the U.S. Navy seeks to homeport in Rota, Spain. These two nations could participate early on within the EPA framework as a beta test for eventual European coverage of a NATO-layered missile defense system. I'd argue that the U.S. Navy should move forward to integrate these navies into the sensor-to-shooter process at the earliest point and exercise a U.S., Dutch, and Danish command and control architecture. Finally, employing the Danish and Dutch frigates into EPAA would be a critical enabler for the U.S. Navy, freeing the Rota-based American ships for other missions or to provide BMD support in the Middle East. Additionally, Denmark and the Netherlands could train and exercise with other navies facing a ballistic missile threat, potentially GCC nations or Asian partners. These efforts would provide additional resources for the United States as requirements for BMD continue to expand globally. In conclusion, implementation of these recommendations would require significant diplomatic engagement by the United States, clearly beyond the traditional military-to-military relationships. The U.S. government must heed the charge from Secretary Gates and challenge select nations to become active security producers. Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and the Netherlands are prime candidates where the return on investment can be quite vivid. Enhanced and interoperable forward partnerships led by Europeans, expanding the freedom of maneuver for the United States Navy, and supporting our rebalanced posture across the oceans.
Good morning. My paper forwards some recommendations specifically, as Peter mentioned, in regards to maritime engagement in Central America. Instead of looking outwards at our partners, I actually looked internally to the way we're organized as a government to conduct that engagement. And I forward that we can build a more robust network between our security assistance functions and our maritime operations. This fellowship has been a great experience, and throughout it, I've attended several events and discussions on Central America, and I think everyone here is aware of the concerns about impunity and the growing violence in the region. There are efforts underway with partner nations that I believe, in my personal opinion, deserve cautious optimism. Right now, that in a sea change that I've seen over the past 20 years, there is universal recognition in the region by our partners that there's no one nation that can solve these problems in this region alone. Additionally, there are some regional initiatives that, in fact, State Department and international organizations are working with Central American partners on security, including, you may be aware of, CICA, which is the Central American Integration System, which is coming together with regional security strategies for all the Central American nations. Security assistance has made clear progress throughout the decades. I have personally witnessed that, and it's hard to attend to visit any of those countries and not have people come up and talk to you about all the training they've had from the U.S. And we've also seen a lot of leadership from the region. The Colombians have stepped up and are reaching out to their neighbors and have actually implemented a maritime law enforcement academy where they invite neighboring nations to come train with them on maritime issues. Southcom AOR, as Peter alluded to, is an economy of force theater with limited U.S. assets, and there's a lot of mission. I think everyone here is aware of the large trafficking and maritime threat issues we have in the region. These organizations are networked, they're agile, they're able to turn their tactics on a dime based on any indication that the international law enforcement community is onto them. And they're using tactics anywhere from high-speed boats that do 40 knots at night across fishing banks to very highly concealed compartments on freighters and fishing vessels. And now, as you've seen in the news, they even have fully submersible submarines that smuggle multi-ton loads of cocaine up the isthmus. They don't just keep their cargo to drugs. They also have movement of money, trafficking in persons, whatever it takes to make a buck for them. Now, I'm going to describe both maritime operations and security assistance in a very brief form for those of you who may not be fully aware of the way we're organized there. All maritime operations are conducted through a center called the Joint Interagency Task Force South. It is a subordinate command of Southcom. It is a DOD command. Because it's DOD, it focuses on detection and monitoring and then hands off the law enforcement case to other partner agencies. It is the gold standard in joint interagency activity. It is studied. They have thousands of visits of academics and government agencies that come down to see how they work because it has such a reputation for multiple law enforcement agencies, DOD, intelligence assets to all come together and focus on the regional maritime threats in the area. I don't want to belabor it anymore, but there is an excellent NDU article, if you are interested in this, called Joint Interagency Task Force South, the Best Known and Least Understood Interagency Success. So then we turn to, let me just describe one thing. I wanted to put in a quick sea story. Last week, Northland detected, as was reported by our Commandant to Congress, detected a smuggling vessel down in the Caribbean under Giadef South Tacon. And the smuggling vessel was moving very fast. We launched a helicopter. We intercepted. They did not stop with warning shots. And a rifleman delivered precision fire into the engines and stopped the boat. The Northland's boarding team recovered 1,600 kilos of pure uncut cocaine at a street value of $42 million. That happens on a routine basis under the tack-on of Giadef South. My report then describes security assistance functions, and this is a highly complex system, but I'll summarize it to say that Congress appropriates the money, and then there's two conduits for that money. It either goes to the Pentagon or to the State Department. They manage the funding for all the security assistance. Security assistance are things like education, training, when we give them equipment, when we sell military equipment to them. They're managed by either the Pentagon or the State Department. And then they go down to work with the COCOM, which would be Southcom, or the country teams. And actually, the country teams do the focus of the planning and the resource allocation for that engagement. Now, the system, like I said, is bureaucratic, and it is cumbersome, and that came out in the interviews. In a May 2011 report, Congressional Research Service indicated that Their members were concerned with fragmented management, unclear reporting chains, and duplicative and overlapping agendas. I don't think some of the people I interviewed would disagree with that. But I will say, based on interviewing all of those people, we have very passionate folks that really enjoy their mission in those programs. And by and large, they cooperate very well within the security assistance organizations to deliver seamless assistance to our foreign partners. And I really was inspired by the way they work through what is a very large system to deliver that assistance. So what I described is an excellent and successful foreign engagement program that is very well networked. I described an operations, joint interagency operations regime that is very well networked. What came out in my interviews, however, is the two are not interlinked in any robust fashion. And so consequently, I recommend in my paper that these two need to be linked to better drive security assistance towards operational objectives and for both programs to inform each other. This is my personal opinion. It's not based on interviews. When I spoke with the JIATF staff and other folks, they were very quick to point out that Southcom, our boss, does security assistance. We do operations. They were very good at staying on point throughout that. My personal opinion is, why do we do business that way? Why are the two not linked, and can they feed each other in a network? So I turned to look to see what network would work. How could we network these to better work together? And I looked at a variety of models, but I came across some discussion that we've had along with some of my colleagues about Afghanistan, and out of personal interest, I began to read about efforts in Afghanistan. And I came across an article by General McChrystal in Foreign Policy, It Takes a Network, and then began to learn how he organized in JSOC and then ISAF over in Afghanistan. A lot of you have heard this story. To summarize it, he flew back from Mosul to headquarters. He essentially drew an hourglass for his staff, and he says, I've been thinking about this is our problem. We have special operations forces on the ground in Mosul who know, they have the ground truth of what's going on. We have headquarters very well informed from D.C. and know what's going on in the country, but we have an hourglass for them. We need to figure out how to network those two so both groups of information are shared. He then turned to his ISAF, and it was a similar problem set for him. He had multiple agencies. He had intelligence, special operations forces, security assistance, USAID, and he realized, as he says in his article, he needed to pull those efforts together, and he had to create a network. Now, the leadership required for this type of network is not the same as a lot of leaders would lead. It's not a directive military form of leadership. It's a lot of consensus and team building and moving a large group towards objectives. JIATF South does that every day, and what I'm merely suggesting is that now they pull security assistance representatives forward into the fold so that there's communication clearly between security assistance and operations. I think security assistance could benefit from seeing the daily battle rhythm and the discussions that take place with operations, and it would be good for JIATF to have a very clear daily dialogue with security assistance organizations. So at the end of my report, I collected, through all the interviews, a lot of things that were suggestions that people had thought about in various parts of various staffs that were good ideas that were essentially put in what we call the two hard locker, just because it was very difficult to link those two organizations. I present those in my paper, and then in form of vignettes at the end of my paper, I run through both operational and security assistance activities and explain how the merger, better communication between those two organizations would enrich the efforts we're making with our foreign partners. Now, as Peter mentioned, this is, as I said, it is an economy of force theater. And the number of U.S. assets available to Jihadi South in the out years right now does not look good. In fact, our commandant just testified to Congress that despite the best efforts of our crews right now, much of our cutters, we call our ships cutters, are in excess of 40 years old, and we're only achieving 70% of our programmed hours, and 50% of the time they're sailing with casualties, mechanical casualties. Additionally, in the naval ships, such as the Perry-class frigates, which are critical to Jihadi South mission and our hemispheric security, are leaving the service. So we have an excellent maritime ops and security assistance organizations that I believe would be enriched by better networking, especially in this time of constrained resources. And it's my firm belief that there will be many benefits if we do look at networking the two organizations. So I look forward to any questions.
Again, Peter, thank you. And, yes, I did travel from California. I'm not used to wearing a tie, and it is very, very early for us from NPS. So with that, I'll go right into it. You heard General Miller talk about a lot of things, the big one being the budget, and that's kind of where my journey started. And then I started looking out for how can we increase our burden sharing. And we've used that term, we've heard that term, and if you go back and look at NATO for the past 60 years, you're going to see burden sharing as a theme that runs through it. But it's never had teeth. Former Joint Chief Admiral Michael Mullen said in 2010 that the single biggest threat to our national security is our debt. And you know the numbers, $500 million. And if sequestration happens, it could go for another $500. That's doable, but we've got to find new and better ways to do it. And as stated before, I'm a special operator by trade. For us, you know, we don't have the highest tech toys. It looks like it, but the aircraft that I flew was made in 1969, the same year I was. And it's pretty darn good. Spectre gunship does it every night, and they've managed to make it work with technology that the computers on board the aircraft are an average of 20, 25 years old, and it works. NATO is kind of going along that, but we know what our defense policy has been, and we know where it's going. The current QDR emphasizes a wide range of strategies and capabilities adopted by today's adversaries. Okay. We're currently looking at revising that QDR, but I don't see that being much of a change. But we're no longer shaping our strategies to revolve around high concentration of boots on the ground. We're no longer sizing forces to conduct large and protracted stability operations. We're not going to do that anymore. The distributed nature of these threats require the ability to surveil, strike, punish from afar, and insert small network ground forces, according to Paul Davis and Peter Wilson out of a Joint Forces Quarterly article that recently was released. So essentially, it's a call to develop innovative, low-cost, and small-footprint approaches to achieve our security objectives, sharing and pooling resources. So let's look at the European model. And talking to some of my NATO brethren over there, you know, he talks about doing business in NATO kind of like the bar scene out of the Star Wars movie. You know, ugly but effective at times, but inherently misconstrued on most cases of being a collective. So NATO has become more of a organizer of collectives, vice being a true collective. And I got a feeling that that's going to be changing very, very soon. We know that NATO has been increasingly involved in out-of-area operations defined as beyond the European borders. Libya is the latest example. And we're looking at an alliance that is now more capable of being a producer of defense rather than a consumer of it. And so a relook is underway. Secretary Gates, once again mentioned before, when he was leaving as the Secretary of Defense and he gave his last address to NATO, I won't say chastised, but he did very poignantly mention that during the Cold War, we underwrote 50% of the defense budget for the NATO countries, essentially by being a part of the alliance. Today, we're up to 75%. I don't think that we'll be able to sustain that, and he pretty much came right out and said that. So in Chicago this summer, for the summit, I would say, again, this transatlantic bargain, this bargain that has been in place for 60 years, is going to undergo a redux. Some change is going to happen. And the Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, his Smart Defense Initiative is exactly where that's going to start. And while there's been that smart defense, that burden sharing, that collective defense strategy out there for years, I think teeth are going to grow this time, because ultimately, none of the NATO partners have, well, with the exception of a few, have made their that 2% GDP defense push. And a lot of them are not going to with the austerity measures that are in place. So there's got to be a way that we can make this work. Because, again, they understand, it's stated out in the Lisbon Summit and the new strategic initiative, that to secure their defense, they have to go out of area to stop the threat before it reaches their shores. A good example of this is the recently flagged NATO Special Operations Headquarters. As early as 1995, NATO realized that while they had many nations that were capable of soft or doing soft-like missions or had a capable special operations force, they did not routinely work together, had disparate C2 and little coordinated and interoperable action. In 2006, the Riga Summit, essentially the nations adopted what is called the NATO Soft Transformation Initiative to come up with a way to create an entity that can take this special operations-like capability from amongst the different nations and bring it together to be able to provide command and control, training, standardization, and interoperability. The U.S. stepped in and said that they would be the framework nation. What does that mean? We underwrite it. We pay approximately right now 87% of the operating costs and provide a majority of the manpower to this headquarters. It's 150 personnel strong. In 2010, it was actually reflagged from the NATO Soft Coordination Center to the NATO Special Operations Headquarters, put under General Lieutenant General Kisner, who was the former SOCIR commander. He did it as a dual hat role, and now it is a completely separate command structure. And it's growing. Their missions are primarily their mission set that NATO Special Operations kind of glom onto is direct action, military assistance, that's a big one, and humanitarian assistance missions. They have a core build and deployable C2 architecture as well as a premier training and standardization function. And just of note, before they came to existence, there was no interoperability regulation, what they call STANAGs, that define what special operations forces in Europe do. Those now exist. There are about 9 to 12, depending on how you count them up, penultimate documents on how we do things in a special operations community amongst the different nations. Understanding that a lot of them have caveats to do what and not to do what type of mission. So back to the bar scene. How do we fix that? And that's what they're going to discuss in Chicago this summer. But Special Operations Command is going forward and trying to, again, provide them with assets. This is an organization that has no organic assets and, again, 150 personnel. We're about to change that by looking at providing them with some aviation capability to build an air warfare center, to give them that primary enabler for Special Operations Forces, which is rotary wing and possibly fixed wing assets, to provide an initial training capability to, again, build their capacity to defend themselves with the U.S. as a supporter rather than supported role. So where can we take this? Kind of started digging around and figuring out, okay, this is a good idea. There's some things that may or may not work, and it's been highly criticized at times. Some of the nations haven't really provided what they said they were going to do, but I believe that if we provide it, they will come. But I started looking at the Pacific. And I that was back in November, is, you know, we could take this and we could put it somewhere else as a bolster to our normal theater special operations command, that interagency, that international body that can take a look at what other soft exist in the region, pull them together, standardize interoperability, that being the key. But there is no NATO in Asia. And I started digging into ASEAN. And the ASEAN Regional Forum. That's the closest thing we can come up with. And we've all heard of the ASEAN way of doing business that emphasizes the culture of non-interference, equality and sovereignty, consensus building, and quiet negotiation, which if you take a look at NATO and United Nations, that is completely opposite of the Western way of doing business. But it works. And so I started digging into it and saying, okay, the ASEAN Regional Forum, that gives that civilian type of control over any type of military entity. However, they haven't stated it as such. But I believe that going forward, unlike NATO, which was formed based on the Soviet threat, there is no definable existential threat to Asia right now. Some people want to talk about China, but I don't believe that they should be looking at that. You should be looking at the threats of WMD proliferation, food security, piracy, and essentially securing the global commons for commerce, because that is the true engine of our commerce today. That's a nebulous threat when you take a look at transnational terrorists and crime, and why should special operations be involved? They're uniquely suited to these tasks of providing, you know, that forward presence, that 911 force, that ability to buy space and time for decision makers to decide if we need to bring that over the horizon, boots on the ground presence, or can they handle it? More appropriately, doing it through special, by, with, and through special operations forces already existing in the theater. And if they're not there, we build them. And I provide a good example in taking a look at it, Jesota, Philippines. Back in 2002, Operation Enduring Freedom Philippines, we established a forward presence in the southern Philippine area going after the Abu Sayyaf group, Jamaat Islamiya, and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, the MILF. That's an economy of force effort that exists today, and they've done the Armed Forces of Philippines, under the tutelage of U.S. Special Operations and some conventional assets, have done a good job of cleaning out their area. Not unlike kind of the ISAF construct we see in Afghanistan, we're providing trainers and then allowing them to go forward to contact with the enemy. And it's economy of force effort, less than 500 people and $50 million a year. Think about how little that would have cost and how less that manpower would have been if we would have been able to bring a construct that involved Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Malaysia, any of the other nations already there in theater. But to do that, we'd have to provide that C2, that command and control architecture, that interoperability. Right now it's being run by the Theater Special Operations Command. If you're not familiar with those are the organizations that present special operations forces to the combatant commander. Well, right now, SOCOM is doing a relook of how those TSOCs work. And they've mostly been doing the we call it the indirect role, providing that presence to do the partner nation capacity building and other types of missions in the area, not necessarily direct action. That TSOC role will always be there as a requirement, that direct action line. But with a regional special operations headquarters in the Pacific or in the Caribbean and South America, Africa, you now have the ability for the U.S. to take that supporting role to provide the interoperability, to provide the command, you know, initially the assets and the training. And if we need to go it alone, we've got the TSOC, we've got the COCOM, we can go forward with the boots on the ground. But if we want to operate as truly part of a coalition, special operations buy you that space and that time. They're already there. That's your persistent presence. Today we've got operators in 100 countries that have been doing this. Special operations forces are regionally oriented. They're usually more mature as far as in service. They've got the language skills. So they are the force that should provide that forward permanent presence, whether rotational or forward-based, to buy us that space and time to continue engagement to show that the U.S. is still part of the regional security construct, especially in these lean times. And I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. Three great presentations. I'll kick us off with a question for each of you and then open it up to the audience here. I'll lay them all three out so you have time to think. At least the latter two will have time to think. Scott, you lay out a great program. Can you go into specifics of how this lack of coordination right now might be expressing itself and to the detriment of current operations? And maybe crystallize the impact that it's having. And then in turn, how you see if we get better coordination following this network model, how that kind of example would be solved. Mike, you lay out a plan that I think makes a great deal of sense from the U.S. perspective, and we would gain a great deal from it. This actually in part applies to Dwight's presentation as well. You know, you cite the Gates' speech, which was applauded here in the U.S., but it landed very differently in Europe. It landed with I don't know whether the phrase is thud or dud. And so what is your sense of the European buy-in to your plan? Why would they want to join on in their own time of budget austerity? What would they get out of it, in particular if it comes with added costs? And then, in part, Dwight, that question can be asked to you, but I think it can be asked in a different way, which is The difference of the NATO model is, while we may be cantankerous about who's, you know, sharing what burden, there's not the kind of, fortunately enough, internal regional tensions in Europe now that you might have in these other areas, specifically in Southeast Asia. That is, we've solved the border disputes in Europe versus the kind of cooperation. And so, you know, the militaries within NATO, it's not just that we can share communications and information in a way that certainly isn't possible with other allies, but between those allies, they're not sharing information, but more importantly, they might not even trust each other. You know, I'm thinking of, the U.S. is cooperating with Philippines, but there's a number of disputes that it touches upon in South China Sea with a number of other neighbors there. So how do you work around those kind of tensions within that structure?
Well, thank you, Peter. I've been thinking about how to respond. I obviously don't want to be careful not to embarrass particular programs, but there are efficiencies within the system that folks are aware of. But I'll describe from personal experience some of the things I've seen where I think we could get some efficiency. I made a port call early on my last ship in a partner nation and saw the Secretary of the Navy. We had some planned engagement, and as I sat down, he said, Scott, I think it's terrific that you arrived just when we have a Coast Guard law enforcement training team on the other side of the base here. I had no idea. It just wasn't linked. We also, late at night, will often be pursuing suspects. Our area of operations is shared with Territorial Seas, so we'll be pursuing a suspect vessel, very high rate of speed towards that country, and we needed to begin to talk with them and then understand how they were going to react. Of course, there's always use of force concerns, blue on blue concerns, and during my tour, I realized that we had standard protocol, but we weren't training to it. We had it, and both sides needed better training and coordination on that. And out of initiative, I reached out to JADF South to someone who had also had embassy experience. We coordinated an ad hoc operation, and I learned about the bureaucracy because it took a long time to get the Leahy Act requirements and everything done. But we eventually set up operations, very short duration. We call them pass exes because it's where forces just happen to be passing, where we would work with foreign forces, and it took very little time out of operations, and we would actually conduct an exercise. We also brought special operations forces that did training with units in conjunction with that. So we actually had security assistance people conducting the training with the foreign force. And we actually netted some narcotic seizures because of that, because we had more conducive communications. These efforts are moving forward, but again, they're ad hoc. And I'm just proposing that we formalize more regular communications between the operators and security assistance, because our strategy is to engage with partners, and I believe that should be a part of what we do with our ships. So.
Peter, that was a great question. Yeah, exactly. You know, the reception over in Europe from a lot of news outlets was that it did kind of ring pretty sour. But I think in my research and looking at, you know, looking at European countries and who would be those entities that might actually take a lead, and that's why I kind of focused on, you know, the three Nordic countries and then the Netherlands. I think they get it. I think in looking at especially the Nordics, they're already looking at they're already conducting either investments or engagements in Africa. The Norwegians are moving, you know, way out front within the Arctic Council on High North policy. So I think the United States can articulate, it may be a little bit of arm twisting because it's going to have to be a political decision in the end. But I think that these candidates would be able to take a lead in security development. And I think that's something is where the United States can go to these countries and say, look, you're already engaged in these regions or you're already taking on these functions. Mm-hmm. Let's help you to transition to that kind of leadership role. You know, whether it's their own bilateral, you know, building partnership capacity aspects or if it's within NATO in some sort of NATO framework. So security development is one aspect. Another one is defense industry. I mean, there's the capabilities. If they're talking about enhancing their own defense angles or exporting some of those capabilities to other countries, you know, it's a business aspect as well. I think, and if you're looking at jobs, lean times, that might be an avenue that they may want to approach as well. And then if you look at those four countries that I discussed, the only one that's stuck in the Euro mess right now is the Netherlands. The Nordics are good. And in discussion statements from the Norwegian defense minister recently, they're being pretty aggressive at what they're looking at as far as future defense investments. So I think those are kind of the talking points that the U.S. government could use and keying on where those countries are already engaged and then helping them to kind of take that lead position. But it's going to be a whole government approach. We're going to have to, and I kind of touched on that, it can't just be the normal mill-to-mill kind of thing. You know, we talk to our counterparts in uniform, and they, you know, they want to do stuff, but it's getting their parliaments, it's getting the civilian politicians to understand that this is in their interest. And that's where I think it can be kind of a open the aperture and make it a wider scope where the U.S. can touch to these countries and push them forward.
Yes, Peter, the Gates speech, you know, when I read it, it was kind of eye-opening that he would actually come right out and say what we've been feeling for a long time. If you're on your way out, you can go ahead and drop those, you know, you can pull the pin on that hand grenade and toss it out. But it was right on the mark. As far as NATO itself, you know, and you talk about out-of-area operations, my focus was not so much on the NATO response force. It was really looking internally at special operations. Of the 28 countries, you can, depending on how you look at their internal security forces and special operations, 26 of them have what they call a special operations force. But most of it is designed to be internal. It's counterterrorism. And we understand that the borders are secured, but they're very fluid. So a lot of things can move around Europe without really much impediment. With the whole EU construct. So NATO in itself is looking at, with the U.S. reducing our force presence, they're going to be more and more, you know, the quote I like is, we're no longer going to be the quartermaster of joint action. And we're going to have to, you know, pull back. But in the area of special operations forces, I look at, well, they're used to doing this type of thing. So if you're taking a look at, like I keep mentioning, that bar scene, it's not so much the case with special operations. By nature, we're trained that way, and we've worked with NATO partners. I've, you know, as recently as a few last year when I was out at Cannon Air Force Base, and in fact, he's actually a student at Naval Postgraduate School now, I worked with Norwegian soft forces had come out and were doing exercises with out on the Melrose Range. And I've worked with them every year for the past 3 years. So we're used to that type of relationship. Going back to, okay, so why are we doing this? With SOF, it was, you know, you go back to, I think the earliest real example is the Olympics in Athens. Counterterrorism is a big deal, and we know we have the Olympics coming up in England. But before we started looking deeply into a smart defense initiative with SOF specifically, you had different counterterrorism forces, special operations, running around trying to protect everybody at the Olympics, but they weren't talking to each other. They were not even talking to the command posts that they had set up there in Athens. They were going back to their regional governments. And maybe that information would flow and maybe it wouldn't. A lot of it is intelligence driven. So to get around this, we do have, it's called BICES. They've developed an internal network amongst the nations that are part of the NATO Soft Coordination Center and even beyond, where they can share this intelligence. It even reaches down into ISAF in Afghanistan. So there is that culture now coming forward of greater intelligence sharing, greater interoperability training, and then you got to ask, well, but the borders are secured. We went into NATO made the decision to go into Libya because they saw it as a possible, you know, you had a humanitarian, mostly driven factor there, in my mind. But with the colonial ties that a lot of the countries in Europe have, they still have interests in, let's say, the Pan-Sahel, northern Africa. They went into Sudan in 2005 to 2007. A lot of it is, you know, for deploying your forces to avoid that threat coming forward. We have piracy missions in the Gulf of Aden protecting, you know, financial interests moving through the Suez. We've got, you know, operations on the Horn of Africa, again, looking for those transnational terrorists that can move across borders. Once they hit Europe, they can almost move with impunity because of the nature of the European Union and that border.
Let me crystallize it, though. The question is not how do you get Norwegian and American soft to work together or to get Norwegian and British soft to work together, because there's a shared vision of threat. There's a 40 years of working together. There's an ability to share communication and the like. What I'm referring to is the challenge as you franchise it, that you will move into regions where the local SOF will be from states that actually have tensions between them. So you, if we're thinking about franchising this in Southeast Asia, well, we've got border disputes, unclear border disputes from pretty much everyone who touches the South China Sea. So the ability of, yes, the U.S. can work well with, say, Philippines or Indonesia, but there may be other, you know, once you drop Australia into the bucket or the tensions between Vietnam or the like, that's what I'm getting at is the idea of, yes, we can, NATO, it's not always perfect, but NATO has figured out how to work together. But how do you take it when it's from states with very, very different interests, particularly when you've got a number of these might involve internal security challenges? That is, I imagine Philippines not so psyched by having, you know, seven different soft states operating inside its borders. Or maybe we, you know, use the example of Indonesia or the like.
Or Latin America would be another great example. We've got states there that with Bolivia, Venezuela, that certainly are not getting along well.
Right, Peter. I, you know, when I started, again, looking at this, I that was one of the things that kind of was rattling around and was some of the critiques I got from the folks that I had, you know, batted this around with at Naval Postgraduate School. And really the only answer I can provide is the U.S. has become an excellent bridging function with a lot of these nations. You mentioned we work well with our special operations forces work well with a lot of these countries. They may not play well together, but if you come in from the light of if we're going to franchise this and truly make it work, we have to be all in. And in the latest dialogues, you know, with the East Asian Summit that happened back in November that President Obama attended, or, you know, this past fall, and then going forward with a lot of the dialogue, again, that ASEAN way, I'm not suggesting that that's a NATO or that it's going to function anything like NATO. But I am suggesting that with those small, discrete special operations forces, if you take it in terms of using the U.S. as the, again, the quartermaster and the trainer, and you work through that third-party construct, you know, we've been running this hub-and-spoke system out there forever with a lot of bilateral and some multilateral with, you know, pretty much everybody that's in that region and that's part of ASEAN. But, you know, I started to map out how all that works, and it was just this convoluted chart that I could barely comprehend myself, much less any of my readers. But I said, you know, we could make it work, and we could make it work in South America. Again, you work the bilateral piece to eventually get to the multilateral piece. It's a long process. It's not something that – it's not a fast food restaurant that I could throw up tomorrow. But I think that I could build something that can capitalize on those habitual relationships we have with member nations to eventually work the piece. Because what we offer is, and that's what NATO SOF headquarters is at working toward, is they each get a benefit because those forces will come home and propagate from within. So they can secure their, you know, they can assure their own security in addition to, over time, a habitual relationship with other nations they might not normally work with to work toward that collective defense. And I'm not saying we're building a security community in Asia with just some special operators, but we're getting, I think, the toehold. Does that kind of make sense?
Gotcha. Let's open it up to the floor. Again, please raise your hand, identify yourself.
Good morning. I'm Mr. Lloyd from Baltimore. My question is about Southeast Asia. Many of you have touched so much about Southeast Asia. Now, with this fluid relationship and boundary between the Philippines and Malaysia, especially in the south, and there is so much piracy going on, human smuggling, trafficking of arms and high-powered weapons, and with the presence of the U.S. forces, especially there in the southern Philippines, and with the growing sort of disturbances of the Muslim insurgent movement, you have made mention of the MILF and the Abu Sayyaf, and with the presence of the U.S. forces there right now. In the part of the U.S. Navy and the Air Force, do you have any plans to increase forces in the southern Philippines? And if so, when and how great the forces would be? Thank you.
Okay. I know of no plans, and I've been living in the academic environment for a year, so I'm giving you everything that I've read. Okay. I know no plans to increase, nor would I see any plan why they would. And this is, again, my opinion. It's not that of the Department of Defense or any. This is just somebody who spent a lot of time reading books and current events. I can't see a reason why we would want to increase our footprint. Again, there are problems, and I recently read that while the Armed Forces of the Philippines did just recently take out a pretty high-powered individual in Abu Sayyaf, the overall operation was completely conducted by them. The U.S. still provides some intelligence sharing operational capabilities in terms of, you know, from teaching guys how to do battlefield medicine to sniper training, but we're not part of any of their operations. It's not our charter. We're there as a training organization. There's no need for us to increase it because our number of trainers is about right sized. That's been about the number for the past 5-6 years. My reason for bringing that in as a case was simply because that is a good example of a low footprint, low signature effort. And again, we are supporting, not the supported force in the area. Does that kind of answer your question?
Thank you. Clara O'Donnell, visiting fellow at Brookings. I had a question for Mike Hannon, and it was, is there a particular reason why you didn't choose to explore options for enhancing cooperation with Britain and France in light of their quite large maritime forces? And I was wondering, are there any areas where you think it could be worth exploring the U.S. strengthening its ties with those two countries?
Sure, yeah. I started looking at that, but then I kind of focused on really what are kind of the, I guess you could classify it as lower-end capabilities. I think if you're talking about Britain and France, you're definitely looking in approaching more of the higher-end warfare, something that's going to involve a lot more research and development, something that approaches kind of what we see with air-sea battle and obviously precision strike, those kind of operations. I think something, especially in either defense realignment or just if you're looking at fiscal priorities, what's going to make it above and below the cut line? And I think that, in my opinion, the U.S. Navy needs to, you know, focus on, obviously we'll continue the relationships that we have with some of our significant partners such and allies such as Britain and France, but, okay, what are some capabilities at that lower end of the spectrum that we may have to kind of franchise out or look to other players to kind of take that leading role. And that's kind of was the focus of my research, whether you're talking about regions like the High North or Africa, or even increasing some functional capabilities, whether it's amphibious operations or humanitarian assistance, you know, disaster response kind of things. So that's where that's how I scoped my research and looking at it is, you know, the U.S. Navy is going to continue on that high end of the spectrum, obviously with allies like Britain and France. So, okay, what of areas that we most likely would probably have to look at for divestiture, who would be, you know, nations that could step up and kind of take the lead on that and that are already either willing or they're already kind of along those lines and taking those approaches currently? Yeah, I think you kind of answered it right there. I mean, those are bilateral activities that those countries are already doing. You know, just that's just what I've kind of, you know, looked at either individually or if you look at especially the Nordic countries that are part of Nordefco, the Nordic Defense Cooperative. So that's areas where they're already engaged. Sure, I'm pretty confident that they're looking at their own interests, whether it's something from resources or, you know, maintaining the global commons. I mean, especially where they're looking at building up, you know, EEZ enforcement or some sort of Coast Guard-like capabilities in those West African countries. Exactly. And I think that's kind of the crux. These countries are looking at that and they're saying, hey, this isn't our interest. I mean, it mirrors a lot of what the U.S. Navy is trying to do for how we maintain and try to guarantee the safety of the global commons. So that's definitely an avenue of approach that where we need, as the U.S., need to then lean into those countries. Hey, you're already working on these activities. Let's assist you and that you can kind of transition into that leadership role.
Steve Winters, local researcher. I'd like to ask Lieutenant Colonel Davis how the current rethink of the COIN strategy, especially as it was promoted by David Kilcullen in Afghanistan, has impacted on the future planned use of Special Operations Forces.
Well, David Kilcullen came out and spoke at Naval Postgraduate School last fall, and I was fortunate enough to have kind of skimmed through the book and then listened to him speak. And, yes, the COIN strategy, and frankly, I'll be honest with you. I'm in the Defense Analysis Department, Irregular Warfare, Unconventional Warfare, Information Operations. That's what we do. And some of the great thinkers are part of that. But this whole counterinsurgency strategy thing, we're kind of going away from that. There's a shift toward more of, you know, irregular war. Well, what is regular war? As of today, I mean, what is regular war and then what is unconventional? So there's a blurring of lines there, and I believe that if you take a look at what's going on in the QDR right now, what the strategists are really thinking of is we're going away from, okay, well, how did the insurgency begin? And there's some excellent work out there by Dr. Gordon McCormick that talks about countering this, but it's from a model that I don't believe exists now because of the transnational nature of the threat. And the fact that we're shifting away from intervention in weak and failing states, in my opinion, that'll be a shift away. So a counterinsurgency strategy won't necessarily be kind of an encompassing piece of work. I believe that's we're now past that. Again, my opinion, but I think you're going to see that's where more of our doctrine and our thought process is going. Anybody else got something on that?
Well, again, thank you to our three panelists. I think you can see it's three very interesting and fruitful lines of research, and we're all, I think you've given us just enough to make us want to actually read, not skim, as a friend of Dave Cullen's. I'm you know, glad he got a book sale from you, but kind of disappointed that you didn't read it. So hopefully we'll all promise to actually read your papers because it's some real interesting research. So please join me in a round of applause.